Hey guys, welcome. I'm so glad you're here. This episode was sponsored by DECRA, and for it, I was joined by Dr. Patty Lathan, one of my very favorite people to talk to about all things endocrinology. In this episode, we dove into diabetes management. The recent approval of SGLT2 inhibitors is a huge leap forward in the management of canine diabetes. And while the availability of these medications is super exciting, because this is a fairly novel therapy in veterinary medicine, there are still a lot of questions surrounding their use in diabetic patients. I feel like Dr. Lathan did an awesome job of diving into some of the more specific questions around SGLT2 inhibitors in those patients who maybe just don't quite read the book when it comes to taking these drugs and present some unique questions and challenges in their management. And of course, there are those who, unfortunately, just won't do well on an SGLT2 inhibitor and will need insulin therapy. We talked about some important updates surrounding insulin therapy, including the start of clinical trials on a novel insulin option intended to be administered only once weekly. Man, what a time to be a veterinarian. If you don't already know Dr. Lathan, let me introduce her and let's talk diabetes. Dr. Patty Lathan is a professor of small animal internal medicine in the Department of Clinical Sciences at Louisiana State University. She earned her VMD from the University of Pennsylvania, then completed an internship at Mississippi State University and a residency in small animal internal medicine at Purdue University. Dr. Lathan specializes in endocrinology, specifically adrenal function testing, diabetes mellitus, and the mitigation of side effects of glucocorticoids. She is currently the past president for the Society of Comparative Endocrinology. Guys, that bio doesn't do her justice. She is an encyclopedia of endocrinology, and I'm so excited to bring you this episode. Let's go ahead and get into it. Well, I'm joined by Dr. Patty Lathan. I love talking to you about all things endocrinology and honestly life things too. But if we go down that road, we'll be here for way longer than we intend to. So instead, let's talk about diabetes. Thank you so much for joining me.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me here.
Absolutely. So let's start with reviewing the pathophysiology of diabetes mellitus. You're like an encyclopedia when it comes to talking about these different pathways. And when we were initially coming up with the ideas for this episode, you used some terms that I probably should be familiar with, but they felt a little foreign to me. So I would love it if you could walk me through that again, just the pathophys of DM.
So it's important to remember that the pathophysiology of diabetes in dogs and in cats is pretty different. Whereas dogs get a type 1 diabetes or kind of like type 1 diabetes in people, it's juvenile onset. Whereas as soon as they become clinical for their diabetes, pretty much all of them are going to require insulin for life because of the fact that their poor beta cells have all been destroyed. So dogs that are diabetic will require insulin for life. That's really the summary of that. Cats that are diabetic are significantly different in that their diabetes generally is more analogous to type 2 diabetes in people or adult onset, which is generally characterized by significant insulin resistance. So cats that develop diabetes, we think, probably have some genetic predisposition to having beta cells that just don't work right. And when they're put to task and told to make a lot more insulin, they fail sooner than other cats' beta cells. So we've got that in the background. And then on top of that comes some cause of insulin resistance, whether it's obesity, pancreatitis, infection, neoplasia, whatever. Something comes along and causes insulin resistance, which then causes the beta cells to appropriately increase insulin secretion. So that's a normal response of endocrine gland, right? When they aren't, the hormone's not working as well, the endocrine gland makes more. So the beta cells make more insulin. And as they make more insulin, along with that insulin is secreted a peptide called amylin. Amylin helps to decrease the blood glucose overall. But unfortunately, when a large amount of it is secreted, it gets together and comes back to the islets where the beta cells are and deposits as amyloid. And I know we've all heard of amyloid in the brains of people with Alzheimer's, for example. It's pro-inflammatory. And unfortunately, when that amyloid causes so much inflammation that it kills beta cells, those beta cells are done. They're not coming back. They're gone. So whatever beta cells they lose because of amyloid deposition they're not coming back. Now, at the same time, what's going on is as the insulin resistance is more severe, then eventually the blood glucose does start increasing a little bit when the beta cells can't keep up. So I'm not talking about like a blood glucose of 300 where they've been clinical for diabetes. This is before that, where the blood glucose may be 150 or so. Well, unfortunately, these beta cells, it's very weird. Not only do they make insulin, but they're super sensitive to hyperglycemia. So when there's a high blood glucose concentration, the beta cells get sick and undergo something called glucose toxicity. So when they have glucose toxicity, that means that they can't produce as much insulin. Now, the great thing about glucose toxicity is that if it's not too severe and we catch it soon enough, it's potentially reversible. So whereas amyloid deposition is not reversible, beta cells are dead from that, glucose toxicity is potentially reversible. So if we catch it soon enough and it's not too bad, then maybe those beta cells can start making insulin again. And when we talk about, you know, cats, you know, cats eventually are going to develop diabetes, right? When they have the insulin resistance, they've got the glucose toxicity, all of it comes together. Eventually they can't make enough insulin. Blood glucose goes up way high and then they become clinical. Well, then we treat them. And historically, of course, we've treated them with insulin. And if we can get rid of the glucose toxicity and the amyloid deposition is not too bad, they can potentially go into remission. Now, if they're a cat that has such bad amyloid deposition, they have no beta cells left, there's no opportunity for remission there. The problem is we do not know a way right now to determine by looking at a cat or any blood work or any specific test, we don't have any way of knowing how much potential insulin secretory capacity is left in these beta cells. So how much of the beta cells are dead due to amyloid deposition versus how much of them could come back from glucose toxicity, we just don't know. So when we've treated them historically with insulin, then we've just had to treat with insulin and hope they went into remission.
That makes sense. See, you've explained that to me before, and I still, like, the second time around took so much away from it. So I'm so glad that you walked through that. And I will probably go back and listen to that again. And I'd imagine there's a few out there that'll be like, hold on. Okay, start from the beginning again. So that's really helpful. And along those lines of treating with insulin historically and kind of monitoring to see if they go into remission, that's part of the concern with these SGLT2 inhibitors that we're now starting to incorporate in diabetes treatment of we don't know how much beta cell function they have left. So before I go too far down that road, can you just kind of briefly review SGLT2 inhibitors?
Yeah, SGLT2 inhibitors are, to me, probably the biggest advance that we've seen in diabetes management since I've been a vet. So I'm guessing most of y'all don't remember from first year physiology that sodium glucose transporters 1 and 2 are found in the proximal tubule of the kidney, and their job is to reabsorb glucose that's been filtered through the glomerulus. So that's the reason normal cats and dogs are not glucose uric, right? Is because the proximal tubule sucks back up that glucose, and it's sodium glucose transporters 1 and 2 or SGLT1 and 2 that do that. Now, SGLT2 in a normal animal is responsible for reabsorption 90% of the glucose in the proximal tubule, whereas SGLT1 is responsible for only 10%. Now, when, say, for example, we give them something that inhibits SGLT2, then SGLT1 amps up a little bit, right? So maybe it's absorbing a higher percent. But these SGLT2 inhibitors, as just alluded to, they're going to stop the reabsorption of glucose through SGLT2. So what's going to happen is these cats are going to dump glucose into their urine, and their blood glucose concentration is going to go down. Now, the great thing about the fact that it's mostly SGLT2 specific is you've still got SGLT1. So whereas when we're giving cats insulin, we've really got to worry about them going hypoglycemic, SGLT1 is still intact, so it sucks back up some of the glucose and helps prevent hypoglycemia. And interestingly, in the two SGLT2 inhibitors present on the market right now, Velagliflozin and Bexagliflozin, none of the cats in those studies showed any clinical signs of hypoglycemia. A few of them in both the studies had biochemical hypoglycemia, but no clinical hypoglycemia, which to me is a huge game changer, because whereas when we were monitoring cats on insulin, we had to check glucoses often enough so that we were sure we weren't making them hypoglycemic. but it seems like the risk of significant hypoglycemia and clinical hypoglycemia with SGLT2 inhibitors or Flozins is pretty minimal. I'm not saying it's not ever going to happen, because these studies, I think they looked at a total of under 350 cats. So we all know that there are going to be some cats that go hypoglycemic eventually, just from the numbers game. But that part's super exciting.
And then we'll have to dig into how much SGLT1 ramps up when we inhibit SGLT2. And there's so many questions to answer there that'll create some really interesting studies.
Yeah. And then another super exciting thing, or super interesting thing about that, probably not exciting for the cats or the owners, but is that even though I make it sound like SGLT2 inhibitors are completely specific for SGLT2, they have maybe a little SGLT1 effect. And we think that that's the case because SGLT1 is also present in the intestines in cats. So Guess what the biggest side effect in cats on these SGLT2 inhibitors is? If you're partially inhibiting the reabsorption of water and sodium and glucose in the intestines, the biggest side effect is going to be diarrhea. 40 to 50% of the cats can develop diarrhea from these drugs. Now, usually it's mild and self-limiting, and maybe you can manage it like supportively, dietary change, etc. But the numbers are pretty high. So again, it's generally not severe, but we need owners, if you start these medications, we need owners to be aware that diarrhea may be a side effect. And none of the cats, the BEXA study didn't have as many cats in it. The VELA study had 252 cats. In that study, two out of the 252 cats dropped out of the study due to diarrhea. But in the BEXA study, none of them did. It's not going to be severe, but it's something owners need to be aware of, because we all know if the cat gets diarrhea 2 days in, the owners are going to be like, oh my God, it's got diarrhea. Whereas if you warned them about it, they may be like, okay, I expected this. It's fine.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Although I do think there's a percentage of owners out there who, if their cat got diarrhea and we didn't warn them about it, they would be like, at least I'm not having to poke him with needles.
Absolutely.
I love that you mentioned dietary changes, because that was kind of where my brain was headed. Like these SGLT2 inhibitors, the physiology, or I don't think physiology is the word, pharmacokinetics of these drugs just blows my mind, how it's like they can just pee it out, but they don't pee out too much and they just have this normal blood glucose. And I think it's so cool, but it makes me even more so than with insulin feel like we should be doing everything we can to really help control that blood glucose level as much as possible. And I always think of nutrition when it comes to my diabetic patients, because I've had several where we're struggling, we change the diet and things really level out and it makes a huge difference. So what are the current recommendations for nutrition in patients with diabetes mellitus? And you know, it's kind of exciting too when you mention the diarrhea, because we're seeing the age of like these multimodal diets and things too.
Yeah, so that's a loaded question, and nutrition is undoubtedly important in these guys. So it's absolutely routine. We have a cat that is diabetic and we put them on insulin. We're going to preferentially put them on a high protein, low carb diet, unless they have other disease that we need to address more specifically with diet. I always tell people, like, if you've got a cat that has bad kidney disease, you know what? I can give more insulin, but I can't make more nephrons. So treat the kidney disease in that aspect. But otherwise, most cats that go on to insulin, we end up recommending high protein, low carb diets. With these SGLT2 inhibitors, really interesting. In the BEXA study, those cats were apparently, or the owners were offered free high protein, low carb diets, but don't know how many of those cats, from looking at the study, how many of those cats actually were on the high protein low carb diet. Whereas in the VELA study, they intentionally prevented the cats from having any dietary change for 2 weeks prior to starting the study, up into, I believe it was a month into the study. Now, the reason for that was to see exactly what this drug would do on its own. You know, if you've got the diet effect in there too, then you're like, well, how much of it was drug, how much of it was diet, which we all know diet's going to help some, but you know, how much is questionable, depends on the cat and all sorts of other factors. But so my point here is, in the study with VELA, they did not change the diet. With BEXA, some cats did, but I don't know how many. My general recommendation, and some of us, you're going to listen to different experts and we're all going to disagree a little bit on this, but the diarrhea, and we'll get to later on diabetic ketoacidosis if it's going to occur, which only occurs in about 5% of these casts, but we need to monitor for it. Those two side effects are most likely to occur during the first 2 weeks of therapy. So during those first 2 weeks of therapy, we're monitoring them for the diarrhea. We're monitoring ketones for trying to catch DK before it occurs. But that's kind of our golden period. So bringing that back to diet, my strong recommendation would be not to change the diet until we get over that 2 week period, because you put them on a new diet and the cat doesn't want to eat, or the cat has diarrhea, or, you know, any of those 8,000 other things. Is it the diet? Is it the drug? I don't know.
Sure, that makes sense. And that's interesting to know. I didn't know that it was like in the first 2 weeks. So that gives you a really good window to say, okay, well, we're going to give it approximately this long, see how they do on the drug, and then we can start making other changes without there being, I mean, there's always gray area in all of these endocrine diseases, but it takes away some of the gray area of when do we make these changes and what do we look for and what are we concerned about?
And I mean, that's not to say those side effects can't occur later, because they do occur later, but the majority of them are going to during the first 2 weeks.
Sure, sure. I think it gives good monitoring parameters, which it's, you're in my head again of going to the next question. Let's talk monitoring. I know this is something that makes me nervous purely due to lack of experience with it. I haven't had the opportunity to manage one of these patients on an SGLT2 inhibitor. And so I know it's supposed to be very similar to monitoring with a glucometer, but can you ease my fears again about monitoring on an SGLT2 inhibitor?
Absolutely. It's actually a little bit more straightforward probably than your brain is thinking, because you've heard all these new things and people are talking about using a ketone meter, which you're like, oh my God, what's a ketone
right.
meter?
What's a ketone meter?
I guess we can actually go there first. So we're going to be measuring ketones, which don't let me forget to get back to timing okay. and everything of that. But for ketones, we can measure it two different ways. We can measure it using a urine dipstick, which we've used historically. And when you're using a urine dipstick, you can use urine, obviously, or you can actually put blood in a PCV tube, spin it, and use the plasma and put it on the tube, because how many cats pee in the carrier on the way to the clinic and you can't get urine? So that's one way to do it. The other way to do it is measuring beta-hydroxybutyrate, which is the ketone that's more present during acidosis. We can measure that in the blood. There's a ketone meter that's been validated in cats. It's called the Precision Extra. And it's about $30 on Amazon. $30 freaking.
That was what Dr. Cindy Ward said. She was like, stop being scared. Yes. You can order it on Amazon. This is not a scary machine.
Yeah, it is not at all. The strips are like a dollar each. You use them just like you'd use a glucometer. So I know a lot of people are like, oh my God, a new meter. I'm going to have to pay a lot of money. It's hella cheap. So when I think of measuring ketones in the urine versus measuring ketones in the blood, I kind of compare that to measuring glucose in the urine versus glucose in the blood. Yeah, it's going to give you kind of an idea, right? If there's no glucose in the urine, you're like, oh, that animal really has a lower glucose, but I don't know exactly what it is. If there are no ketones in the urine, you're like, okay, well, it's lower. But if you've got glucose in the urine or ketones in the urine, what does that actually mean? We just know it's there. I don't know what the amount is. You know, people have tried to compare how much glucose is in the urine to what the blood glucose is. And we all know it's so inexact. So when we start, first of all, I should go kind of backwards. You don't want to start a cat on these medications if they have ketones. If they have any ketones based on your analysis, you should not start them on these drugs. However, if you use a ketone meter, and they have a ketone concentration, if they're healthy acting, eating, drinking, et cetera, and their ketones are less than 2.4 millimole per liter, then you can start the drug, but you need to monitor them and make sure they don't go up. If they're less than one, we're super happy, right? That's like a negative on the urine strip. So there's a little bit more leeway if you're using a ketone meter, because you have actually have numbers. Whereas if you get a positive on a urine strip, that is, don't start. Or if they're on the drug already, you've got to discontinue the drug and go to insulin. Whereas if you've got a ketone meter, if they're less than one, you're golden. If they're greater than 2.4, that's not good. But if you're in the 1 to 2.4 range and they're healthy, then you're welcome to either start it, or if you're in the monitoring phase, continue the drug. But make sure you watch them closely, maybe check again in 2 to 3 days.
That seems like a pretty straightforward way to kind of like write an SOP on it of like, this is when you get presented with this case, here's what you check for, here's your monitoring parameters, here's when to start and when not to.
Yeah, we were talking about ADHD earlier, and I had all these ideas in my brain when I finally put this kind of my own algorithm on a slide. And I'm like, okay, that's kind of what I'm thinking. The other thing is, so let me go forward a little bit on timing of assessment. You're obviously going to do your minimum database prior to starting cats on these drugs. I should mention neither of these drugs is FDA approved for cats that have been on insulin before. Bexa, in their paper that was written, published last year, none of the cats in that study had been treated with insulin before. In the Vela study, 38 of the cats in the study had been treated with insulin before. Both of these studies showed like an 80% success rate overall in the cats. However, if you look at the previously insulin-treated cats in the Vela study, they were less likely to successfully complete the study, and they were more likely to develop DK. So there were some cats that absolutely had been treated with insulin before up to years, and they were successfully treated with Vela and did not develop DK. But if anybody's going to go off label and use it in a previously insulin treated cats, I will say we have more data on Vela. Make sure you warn the owners that A, it is not FDA approved for this cat. B, they are less likely to be successful treating this cat than they would if the cat hadn't been on insulin before. And C, they're more likely to go DK. But going back to monitoring.
I think so, it was good, though, because, you know, there's going to be those cases where it's like, I know that this is not approved and I know that I'm not supposed to do this, but this owner cannot give insulin anymore. And, you know, this cat's, we're going to euthanize otherwise. Like, let's give it a try. So I think that gives like some good communication points and good recommendations to us of how to monitor those patients.
Absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of exclusions for using these drugs if they've got any clinical disease. Basically, they have pancreatitis, that's an exclusion. But my opinion is kind of like, A, if they have chronic pancreatitis and they're clinically fine right now and they haven't had problems for a while and they're eating well and stuff, it's fine. I don't even recommend checking a PLI ahead of time unless they're clinical for something, because I don't even know what to do with PLIs these days in a non-sick animal. So just checking everything, making sure they're otherwise healthy. So once we start them on these medications, obviously we're going to have the owners monitoring at home, letting us know if they're eating, drinking, obviously, if there's any vomiting or diarrhea. Obviously, these are oral medications, and any oral medication can make a cat vomit. So you got to distinguish the difference. Did the cat hypersalivate and or vomit 30 minutes after they got the drug, or were they doing fine and then suddenly they stopped eating and vomiting and such, where you're more worried about DK, right? So have a monitoring at home. The first recheck is going to be at 2 to 3 days, then 7 days, then 14 days, then at a month, 2 months, and then every 2 to 3 months afterwards. During the first 2 weeks, my focus is really on, are these cats healthy and safe to continue this is it safe to continue this medication, right? So number one, we're checking ketones. If the ketones are above 2.4 or positive on the urine strip, that's a stop. That is a stop, move to insulin. So don't give the, they probably came in after giving the medication once a day in the morning or at night. Actually, it can be given at night too, but they probably came in at that point. Then I would just say the next, honestly, if their glucose is high and they've got a little ketones, I would start insulin that evening, honestly. So start your insulin on them. However, if the ketones are negative, we're good to continue the medication. If the ketones are positive on the urine strip, and that's all you're measuring, you've got to stop it. But if the ketones are positive on the urine strip, then you may say, okay, well, now we should check a BHB on the ketone meter. And if it's between 1 and 2.4, I'm comfortable saying, okay, let's recheck again in 2 to 3 days, right? And we're going to check that again at 7 and 14 days. Hopefully we get through that period without having problems. When you're checking these, we're also going to check glucoses just to have an idea. You know, these drugs are ridiculous in how fast they decrease the blood glucose. These cats can have glucose curves within the reference range in 1 and 2 weeks. It is absolutely crazy. Yeah. I mean, with insulin, yeah, we want to get them in remission, but especially when I'm talking about dogs, I'm not expecting them to have normal blood glucose the most of the time. These cats do. It's kind of crazy. So for the first 2 weeks, again, mostly monitoring signs, side effects, ketones, glucose. Some people like to measure fructosamine. I don't think that's absolutely necessary. Some people talk about measuring glucose curves. I personally don't feel like it's absolutely necessary to do glucose curves unless, say, they're having clinical signs of hypoglycemia, but you're seeing them in the morning after they got the drug, and we know the drug's gonna be more effective later in the day. So if you think they're having signs of hypoglycemia and you don't catch it in the morning, then maybe do a glucose curve throughout the day or put a Libre on them or whatever. Or if it's a cat where you're at the 30-day mark, where you're doing the same monitoring, but you're also trying to assess whether it's effective or not. And the owner's kind of like, maybe it's effective. I have 17 other cats. I'm not sure if the cat's better or not at this point. You're like, okay, let me check a glucose curve because the glucose in the morning was high, but I expect it to go down later on. And if it's not going down at all, if the fructosamine's not going down at all, we're not confident the clinical signs are improved, then that's probably going to be a failure cat. If the cat has not improved by 30 days, probably not going to improve on this drug, and we need to move over to insulin. And again, some cats just aren't going to improve. If they are an amyloid cat, or if they're a cat that has so much amyloid deposition that they have no ability to make insulin, they're probably not going to improve. The other thing is they're going to be more predisposed to developing DKA, right? Because remember, DKA is caused by insulin deficiency and concurrent disease. It's not caused by hyperglycemia. So just because their glucose is not high doesn't mean they can't develop DKA, which comes back to a lot of times when cats do develop DKA with these medications, it is euglycemic DKA. Their glucose is actually within reference range or below 250. So if you see one of these cats that comes in and it's sick, not eating, vomiting, etc., but the glucose is within reference range, you need to know that if these cats are on this medication, you've got to check for ketones. And if you have the option, check for some sort of acid base status. If you're in a hospital where you can't measure acid base status, but they've got ketones and they're acting sick, then you got to assume they're a DKA and treat them as a DKA. And you treat them pretty similarly to cats that have regular DKA where their blood glucose is high. It's just that in these cats, they may come in with a blood glucose of 100. So if you remember kind of the algorithm for treating DKA, that means you've got to not only start them on insulin early on, but you've got to start them on dextrose immediately. In these cats, you may go up to dextrose of 7.5% to make sure that you can keep giving them insulin, because it is critical that you give these cats insulin because they're DKA ketotic because they don't have any insulin to inhibit those ketones.
That's probably another answer I'll go back to and listen to again, because I think there's a lot of good monitoring parameters. And then I love that you mentioned the algorithm for treating DKA, because I love an algorithm, and that's about the only way that I can manage these patients without getting panicky. Thinking about cats and vomiting, like we mentioned with DKA, euglycemic DKA, but of course, cats. They just vomit. Like you said, maybe 30 minutes after they got the med, they didn't tolerate it. And that kind of took my brain to this place of, well, we have two different formulations of these drugs. One's a tablet, one's a solution. And cats are going to tolerate things differently, and we never really know which one they're going to choose. So if we have a cat on one Flozin and they're not tolerating it, the owner thought the tablet would be easier, thought they could hide it because the cat was polyphagic. Now the cat's not polyphagic, they can't get the tablet in anymore. They want to switch to a solution. Is there any data on switching back and forth between the two?
Yeah, unfortunately, because these drugs are so new, obviously the companies did not decide to work together to figure out
I'm
what would
shocked to
happen.
hear this
I know.
now.
So we don't have any data on that. What I've told people is honestly, if they've been on one and they want to go to the other, then generally, probably the reason they want to go to the other is because the cat won't take it. So the cat probably hadn't even been on it for a few days.
That's a
But
good point.
if they're switching from one, say somehow they got the Bexa into the cat one day. And then they're like, dude, I'm going to a liquid formulation. I'm going to go to Vila or Simvelgo. So then my opinion is you can probably go from one drug to the next day to day. I mean, don't keep going back and forth, but that you can. So if one day they had Bexa, then you decide to change the next day, they could probably go over to Vila. However, I would start the monitoring process over because even though we know that the side effects are similar, I don't know if. Because they didn't get diarrhea with Bexa that they're not going to get diarrhea with Vila or vice versa and such. Also, ketones. I don't know whether that's going to change between the two. So I would recommend going back to the beginning. Now, one thing I forgot to mention, and of course, this is not on the label for either of them. I forgot to mention, you know, at the 2 to 3 day mark, how many people that just got their cat diagnosed with diabetes are willing to bring their cats back into the hospital at 2 to 3 days? Or how many of them have cats that will tolerate that? Again, not recommended, but if you have an owner that will not bring the cat back in at 2 to 3 days, the other thing is to send them home with a ketone strip for the urine. And if the cat's doing great and they check the urine ketones and it's negative, you're probably good. I mean, yes, it would be great for us to have eyes on it, but I don't want you to not use these medications because the owner can't bring it back at 2 to 3 days.
Sure. And you know, we do those kinds of solutions with owners all the time with cats with diabetes, yeah, of, you know, having them monitor the mm-hmm. urine at home or check the Libre and stuff like that. So like you said, not ideal. Hopefully we can do some bargaining of like, hey, I won't make you stick your cat with needles if you will bring him back in 2 to 3 days. But if it's just not doable, or, mm-hmm. you know, we have one that wants to claw our faces off when he comes in, then at that point, it seems like a good solution to still be able to put the cat on this drug.
Yeah, I mean, if it's positive at that point, then they need to have a ketone meter checked for BHB, but hopefully it won't be.
Yes, yeah, but let's make it worth it for that cat if we have to bring him mm-hmm. in. A question about remission, because we talked about with these drugs, they need to have functioning beta cells in order to use them. So I would assume there's maybe a possibility of remission using the Flozins. How can they go into remission, and is it different from what we would see with an insulin treated cat?
Yeah, so that's a loaded question that we don't have numbers on, because both of the studies, they were clinical trials, right? So what happened is they were put on the medications, they were given the medication during the trial, and then they didn't get the medication anymore, which made some of the owners very sad. But actually, you mentioned Cindy Ward previously. She was involved in the Vila study. She was actually had some of the cats in the Synvelgo Vila Glyphosin study. And what she said is some of the cats, of course, after 6 months, the drug wasn't available anymore. And the owners were like, you need to give insulin. They said they need to give insulin. And the owners were like, nah, I can't give insulin. So obviously some of the cats didn't do well, but at least a couple of the cats that she had ended up going into remission at that point. And of course, we have to remember that when we talk about remission, it's not that the cat's beta cells are suddenly all healthy. They've still got that some amyloid probably. They've still got some genetic predisposition. They're just not requiring insulin to maintain their glucose concentration. I think there are arguments for if the owners have the financial ability and it's easy enough, maybe continuing these medications because it will keep their glucose within reference range for a longer period of time. And if it were a cat that did go in remission but then came out of remission, then that duration of period when their beta cells are having to work harder, then I think more of them may end up dying and then eventually make it so they don't have the opportunity to be treated with these medications. So if it were my cat, and I would end up keeping my own cat on the drug longer period of time if we're easy enough. But the short answer is, I think that some cats are going to go into remission on these medications. The question is how to figure it out. If the glucoses are normal on the medication, you don't know what they're going to be off medication. And within the group I've been working with on this, we've all had differing opinions on what to do with it. One person's like, well, a bottle of Synvelgo lasts for 3 months in a 5-kid cat. So after 3 months, just stop it and see what happens. And I'm like, oh, that worries me. I mean, I don't know what will happen then. My thought was, well, with Bexa, it's one pill per 3-kid cat. So I don't know how you would do this with that. I'm sure you could split the pill, but I don't know anything about that. With Synvelgo, my thought is, well, when you got 2 weeks of the drug left, what if you just gave them half the dose? Because I know that half the dose works in a lot of cats, just not all cats. So maybe you half the dose and then see what happens a week or two later. See if they're still euglycemic. And if they're still euglycemic, then you could potentially discontinue it. If they're not euglycemic anymore, then they're probably not going to be a remission cat.
I think that makes sense with what you're saying, because like we talked about before, we need the beta cells in order for these drugs to work. And so to take them off completely, unless there's like a really significant reason why, like so much that we see with diabetes, of we have to take so much of this on a case-by-case basis. If we do take them off and they get that amyloid deposition again, then eventually these drugs could be a failure and now we're back to insulin. So why take that risk unless it's a patient where you have a really good reason to? I did not know about reducing the dose, though. Of course I didn't, because I haven't had the opportunity to manage these patients yet. But that's an interesting thought to say, like, let's try it and see what happens. And then if that glucose does start to come up, at least it's not coming up quite so high and you're watching for it.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether that information is somewhere out there or that's information I got from BI that when they were doing the dosing studies. And this happens with a lot of drugs, right? I mean, I know it happened with DOCP. A lot of the cats, or with DOCP, they dogs responded to a lower dose, but not all of them. So they increased the dose, and that was the dose they ended up using.
Okay. Okay. Oh, that makes sense. So a lot of them will respond to the lower dose, but they're using the one that the higher dose all of them will respond to.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
And that's actually interesting, because if they get diarrhea on Cymbalgo, that's another thing you could potentially do, is see if half the dose works.
Oh, that's a good, yeah. Cause then we're not inhibiting quite as much. Well, per usual, we're talking on and on, and I know we're going to run up on time here. So real quick, you know, we focused a lot of our talk here on the SGLT2 inhibitors, but important updates or considerations when it comes to insulin therapy?
Yeah, there are a couple that I can go through real quick. First of all, Detemir, which I've loved for a long time to use in big dogs because it's more potent and I can use, say, 8 units of insulin twice a day in a Great Dane. That information for you is no longer useful because Detemir is going off the market at the end of the year. This is what happens with human insulins. They go on and off the market per what is necessary in people. And there's some other new insulins out there that are used more than Detemir. So don't start a dog on Detemir. The other super exciting thing that's happening in the world of diabetes right now is that glargine, or Lantus, which is U100 glargine, you can now get for $35 for a 10 mil bottle, or $35 for 5 of the 3 mil pens if you use a good RX coupon. So make sure you use the good RX coupon. But this is a game changer to me. Glargine is now probably the cheapest insulin out there to effectively use in cats. 6 months of insulin effectively for $35.
That's wild. I remember when it was like 300, even more than that at times.
Oh, yeah.
Like it would go up to like 600 plus, I think, at certain times. That's $35. Goodness gracious. That is exciting.
It's almost ridiculous thinking about the change in price there.
Absolutely. I have questions, but that's a whole nother topic. Well, and of course, you know, the reason the SGLT2 inhibitors are so exciting is because twice daily insulin administration is not really a fun thing in most cats, unless you just have like the most laid back orange tabby in the world who doesn't care if you poke him with needles. I have heard rumors about a once weekly insulin administration, which seems maybe too good to be true. Is there any merit to those rumors?
Yeah, this is going to be another super amazing advance in veterinary endocrinology after the studies are done. So there have been a couple of studies looking at cats and dogs in a week-long insulin. In dogs, in 5 out of the 6 dogs studied, or is it 4 out of 5? In any case, there was one dog it didn't do as great in. But in most of the dogs that were studied, they showed that this once weekly insulin resulted in just as good glycemic management and management of clinical signs in diabetic dogs as twice daily insulin. So the once weekly insulin worked just as well as the twice daily insulin in most of these dogs. Now, one of those dogs developed antibodies to the drug, but then later was able to be managed on twice daily insulin. So it didn't mess that up. So that's super exciting. And in cats, similar findings. Cats were on twice daily glargine and they showed similar regulation on once weekly insulin. So this is an insulin that was created by Axton, but Dechra bought it. So they're getting ready to do clinical trials on it. So it's probably going to be a few years before this drug actually makes it to the market. But yeah, keep your ears open. Twice daily insulin obviously causes owners to have to adjust their schedule and cause a lot of inconveniences, especially like when they want to go out of town. But now we've got this oral medication, and then maybe we've got this weekly medication, which is going to change the lifestyle for these people that have diabetic patients and their pets.
It's super exciting. That, I mean, between oral medications and once weekly injections, I mean, I feel like a lot of lives can be saved.
It is so exciting to be an endocrinologist right now. It's
yes,
just amazing.
Between diabetes and kidney disease, like there's so many things happening right
yes.
now, and I'm having so much fun talking about all of them.
Yes, our pharmaceutical companies have been working to get this stuff done. It's awesome.
Yes, yes, and very helpful. I know with a lot of these medications, like I said, I haven't had the opportunity with the SGLT2s yet, but some of the other stuff, it's been really cool, and just it's a fun time to be a veterinarian.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. I've learned so much, as always. Even though we had the opportunity to talk before and I got to ask a couple questions before, I still always learn so much the second time around when we're talking about all these things. So thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Keep us posted on all these super exciting updates.
Yeah, thanks for having me. We always have fun on here.
Okay, if you walked away from this episode and didn't at least learn something about the management of diabetic patients and SGLT2 inhibitors and insulin therapy, then kudos to you, because I took a lot away from it. Thank you so much, Dr. Lathan. It is always so much fun. Thank you to DECRA for making this episode possible. And of course, thank you to everyone for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast. It'll help other veterinary professionals like yourself find this and other great content we try to put out there. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to hear more, click on the Education tab on the Vetfolio website. As always, we'd love to hear your input on this talk, as well as ideas for topics you'd like to hear from us in the future. Feel free to reach out to me at dvm@vetfolio.com. You can also visit my Facebook page at Dr. Cassie DVM, and you can find me on LinkedIn. And remember, if one animal is better off because of you today, it's a great day.